Welcome to Headlines Radio. This week our guest will be Harav HaGaon Rabbi Yehuda David Bleich, the Rosh Yeshiva of Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan. He is also a noted authority on Jewish medical ethics. Rabbi Bleich has also testified in front of Congress and been appointed by the governor to the Commission on Life and Law. Following Rosh Yeshiva, we will have Rabbi Peretz Scheinemann, the Dean of the Torah Academy of New England, speaking about raising a child in our consumerist society. Next week, our topic will be bankruptcy in halacha with Harav HaGaon Rav Herschel Schechter of Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan, followed by Dr. David Pelkowitz, who will be speaking about raising a teen with the internet. So this week, our topic is vaccinations. Do we have to vaccinate, or can you follow the minority of opinions who don't allow for vaccine, who don't require vaccinations? And additionally, we'll be speaking about a school that does require vaccinations. Can it refuse accepting a child whose parents don't want it to be vaccinated? Welcome, Rabbi Bleich.
Shalom Aleichem.
Shalom Aleichem. So, Rabbi Bleich, you know that many people do not believe in vaccinations. There was recently in Lakewood a number of letters that came from Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky, signed by Rav Melchior Kotler, etc., that said that parents do not have to vaccinate their children. And I was curious, in your opinion, what is the halachic view? Does a child, does a parent have to vaccinate their child?
I can't address what whatever opinions have been voiced by others. Halavai, that there should be enough time and diligence to become proficient in Gemara, Rishonim, and the Peskim. I can only deal with the sources in Halach as we have them, and then try to apply them to the facts. And there may be some confusion with regard to the facts as well. So let me just talk in general. The basic principles are well known. Everybody knows that there's an obligation, a mitzvah of nishmarta meidl nafshisechem, hishomer lecho, hishmar nafshecho. The Torah tells us that there are certain things that are prohibited, and if we talk about individual acts or forms of conduct, there is often some controversy among Peskim, whether it's an Issa d'Oraisa or an Issa d'Rabbanan. In addition to that, there are clearly things that are prohibited by Chazal, and those are clearly takonis. The takonis are all in instances in which the danger is a kind of a chashash rochek, not very likely that the activity will lead to danger, but nevertheless, Chazal found it necessary to prohibit them, and they are enumerated, recorded in the Rambam, recorded in Shulchan Aruch. Everybody knows about the prohibition against drinking water, which has been left overnight because of the possibility that a nochash, a snake, may have deposited some venom in the water, and the machlekes ha'peskim with regard to whether it is applicable in locales in which there are no such serpents. But that is clearly an instance in which we're dealing with a particular takona. And the first issue is whether the prohibitions, which don't rise to the level of an Issa d'Oraisa so high that it's clearly prohibited because the Torah says that you have to be careful with regard to preserving your life, whether these are individual instances that Chazal prohibited or whether it's a general prohibition. The Ramah in Yerdei Kufte Zayin seems to indicate that everything that is recognized as being a danger is prohibited, and it's not limited to just what Chazal expressed or expressly prohibited. So we've got a dangerous conduct which has to be avoided, even when the danger seems to be remote and rather minimal. Insofar as taking proactive measures or prophylactic measures to ward off possible dangers, we have a number of sources. There's the well-known Gemara in Brochus. The Mishnah says that if there is a nochash, one of these snakes, that is coiled around the foot. The person shouldn't be masik, he shouldn't interrupt in Shemin Esrei. And then there came a sar, some government official, and one of the Amoraim didn't respond to his greeting, and he quoted the psukim at him and said, "Peteraschem ksuv." And the Gemara quotes this, which gives the impression that the non-Jew was not totally incorrect in citing the pasuk. The response and why the Amora didn't interrupt is a separate issue. But here we're dealing with someone who is not responding. It was the absence of a response that caused the danger, and it was something that was necessary to do in an active, overt way in order to avoid the danger. And by the time you get to Acharonim, the Mogen Avraham, the Mishnah Berurah, quote a shloah that say at the time of a cholera epidemic, a person should leave the city in order not to be afflicted with cholera. That's certainly something which is active. So there, it's clear that, and the Rambam in Hilchos Deis and Perek Dalet, the Rambam speaks about something entirely different. He says that a guf bori v'sholem is midarkei Hashem. You've got to have a body that is healthy, and he proceeds to add that without a healthy body, it's the evsher sheyovin or yeda v'huchayla, a sick person. I presume when he speaks about Yovin, he means understanding, and Yeda probably refers to the mitzvah of Ahavta Hashem Lekecha, which for the Rambam means Yediyas Hashem. You can't concentrate on serious things if you're sick. So it's from the Darkei Hashem, preserving a healthy body. The Rambam includes in the Mishnah Torah as a halacha. Apart from any other obligation, it's certainly Midarkei Hashem. So it would certainly sound as if whatever can be done to preserve health and inoculation against disease is certainly within the ambit of those obligations, is something that a person should do. Precisely the nature of the obligation may not entirely be clear. It may be included in this general mitzvah of Yishomer Lecha, and it may be simply that a guf bori v'sholim is required.
But Rabbi Black, let me quote from the letter, which he
No, please, let's not quote letters.
Let me tell you his point.
Ask me in your own words.
Okay, in my own words. His the points would be, those who would disagree would say as follows. They would say that there are medical doctors, be it a minority opinion, who believe it's dangerous to inoculate. And in all the prior cases, there is no minority that says that it's dangerous. And a parent has a right to say, I accept the minority opinion. That's point one they make. And the other point is, according to the Center of Disease Control, there were 200 cases out of 300 million Americans last year where the lack of inoculation caused disease. So it's a chash that is so rachik that they say, well, you're not really making much of a difference. It's just so remote. Those are the two points that they would respond.
They're both based upon factual error. Let me start with the first. Number one, the point that there is danger in any procedure is absolutely correct. The Ramban, the Teres Odom, says, "Ein l'chosam shemerapel l'zeh, shein ameimis l'zeh." Medicines are by definition potent. If they wouldn't be potent, they wouldn't do anybody any good. And there is the attendant danger that they can do harm. That doesn't mean that one shouldn't take medicine when one is sick. The issue, and we can talk about it later if we have enough time, what constitutes the threshold of a danger that has to be taken into account, into consideration. When we're talking about vaccinations, we are certainly talking about things that can be dangerous. Question is, and what is the danger? It turns out that the danger is extremely minimal. Minimal to the point of being non-existent, and they've been grossly exaggerated. Let me also say, before I try to amplify that comment, that there is no respectable body of medical opinion that counsels against vaccination. There's been much in the media, popular press, about MMR, measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine that causes autism. That was the result of an article that was published in 1998 in Lancet. It's a highly prestigious British medical publication. And it was the result of a study. It contradicted earlier studies, but it pointed to significant danger. The only problem is that the study was exposed as a total and complete fraud. The primary author of the study, a gentleman by the name of Andrew Wakefield, had his medical license removed. He was deprived of the right to practice medicine because he had perpetrated a fraud. If you look at other forms of vaccine, in terms, some of these are against diseases which carry very significant danger. We don't have to talk about polio. Polio has virtually been eradicated as a result of vaccination. It was once a scourge. Mumps, mumps are virtually eliminated. And in 2009, there was an outbreak of mumps in upstate New York, and it turned out that it was in a community in which the children had not been vaccinated. Now, mumps, most vaccines, do not confer immunity 100% of the time. Mumps, I'm told, carries a 90% immunity, and before there was mass inoculation for mumps, in the United States, there were approximately 152,000 cases of mumps a year. Recent years, the numbers have been in the vicinity of 1,700. Now, that is a tremendous decline. The mortality rate in developed countries for mumps is 1 to 3 per 1,000. And there have been no fatalities in anything near that order that can be associated with the vaccine. The vaccination against measles carries 95% immunity. And again, in 2011, there was an outbreak in a community in Brooklyn, and it turned out that it was in a group of people who had not been vaccinated. For rubella, the success rate, immunization rate, approaches 100%. Now, the other little fact that you quoted was that we have so few of these cases that it's really chash rochok, and you don't have to really be concerned. And the answer to that is that it's a half-truth. It is true. And the fact that we have so few cases and certainly even fewer fatalities is precisely because we've had successful immunization campaigns. It's what in medicine they call the herd effect. You don't have to vaccinate 100% of all people in order to eliminate a disease. I am not an epidemiologist. I won't tell you how many you have to vaccinate. But when you get to a very, very high percentage, the others who are not vaccinated are not going to catch the disease because there's nobody to catch it from. If you don't have this type of mass vaccination, and there are a lot of people out there who have not been inoculated, if one of them gets it, then you have a larger pool of people who will contract it, and the people, the unvaccinated people, can spread it even to vaccinated people, because with most of these, there isn't a 100% immunization rate, and they're not 100% effective. And the people who are not immunized will be able to catch the disease. And the more people you have who aren't vaccinated, the greater is the likelihood that those ones, even the ones who have been vaccinated but the immunization wasn't effective, that they will contract the disease. So you have a strange kind of situation. if you have 100 people and 99 of them are vaccinated, the 100th can probably get away without a vaccination, and neither he nor anybody else will be endangered. By the time every one of the 100 says, I'm the one who doesn't have to bother going to the doctor and getting a shot, then nobody has a vaccination, and you're back where you started from. What happened in both the mumps breakout in 2009 and the measles in 2011 was that you had a significant concentration of people in a community who weren't immunized, and they were living in a closely knit community and were able to spread the disease one to the other because there was at least one outbreak, and then there were all of these others who weren't vaccinated and they contracted it. Had everybody been vaccinated, you would have heard about an isolated case in the community, that somebody got it in one way or another, but it didn't spread. Because there were so many people who weren't vaccinated, it spread from the one who managed to get it. That's essentially what we're dealing with. So it's the question of the herd effect. If everybody or a large number of people opt out of vaccination programs, then you're going to return to the bad old days in which these diseases were highly prevalent.
We're speaking to Arava Goyen, Rabbi Yehuda David Bleich of Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan, and the topic is vaccinations. So, Rabbi Bleich, what would you say, does a yeshiva have the right to tell a child who's not vaccinated to say, we will not accept you?
The answer is very complicated, and I don't think it's an answer of one size fits all. It depends upon the circumstances, and it strikes me as a little bit odd. We live in a society in which many sectors of our community are very concerned about uniformity, suppressing individualism, and we have produced a community in which there is a great deal of conformity to accepted norms, even when that hasn't the vaguest thing to do with halacha. Things that are entirely social and of no importance whatsoever, at least standing alone. The color of a shirt or the color of a hat is a good example as any. On the other hand, I suffer from a disability. I'm an American. And the people who grew up in an American culture were exposed to notions of libertarianism, individualism, that society shouldn't try to dictate to people what they should or should not do. And here I find myself answering questions about communities that don't want to enforce a vaccination program, and I'm here saying that it probably should be enforced, even though I say at the very outset I would prefer not to enforce it. I would prefer to use whatever powers of moral persuasion are available to get conformity rather than trying to force people to compel. Now, we're dealing with technical areas of halacha, and they have to be carefully defined. We have a kind of a tension between principles that, if not contradictory, are certainly antagonistic. You've got Mamori Chazal that say this, Osu Lamed B'mokim Sakana, you can't place yourself in a place of danger even when the danger is remote. And then you have a concept of Shemer Psoim Hashem. The Rabbanu Shel Olam preserves people who rely on him, who don't ask too many questions. When do you apply one, and when do you apply the other? When can you say, I'll be a Baal Betochen, the Rabbanu Shel Olam will take care of me, and when do you have to take measures so that the Rabbanu Shel Olam won't kaviyochol be put to that kind of a trouble? Well, the concept of Shemer Psoim is first and foremost a societal concept. If people don't regard a given activity as being dangerous, then it's fairly safe to say that in terms of halacha, it's not usur. Unless, of course, it's something that Chazal prohibited because of chashash rochok, so that if you don't perceive the danger, as far as halacha is concerned, the danger doesn't exist. Let me give you an example. I am absolutely convinced that if you live in the city of New York and probably most other places, the greatest danger in getting a vaccination is the automobile or the taxi ride to the doctor's office. Far, far more dangerous than anything associated with the vaccination. Yet we're here discussing people who are afraid of vaccination because they're told it's dangerous, and nobody is talking about the danger of motor vehicle accidents. It's because motor vehicle accidents are well within the category of shem or psoim hashem in normal circumstances. We don't perceive it as a danger, and therefore you don't have to scrutinize the activity, and you can rely upon the Rabbeinu Shlomo, rely upon hashgacha. Now, that is not an absolute principle. There are a number of tshuvas that define the categories. The classic tshuva, the one that's probably best known, is Rabbi Yaakov Ettlinger in the Shomer Tzion,
in the Binyan Tzion
of Rabbi Yaakov Ettlinger. He, in effect, asks the question, Abot Tzrichim Lahoidos, they have to make a Birkas Hedor, thanking the Rabbeinu Shloim for saving you from danger. And when there was a Beis HaMikdash, you had to bring a Korban Teidah for this. That means there must have been a danger. The person who was a Chaylov Nisrapa, he had a dangerous illness and he was cured, couldn't do anything about it. A Yetzim Beis HaAsurim, it was somebody else who wanted to kill him. But what about Yordei Hayam, who told him to go in the first place? They didn't have to place themselves in danger. If it's also to the Oymid B'mokim Sakona, where do they get license to go on a dangerous sea voyage? So the Binyan Tzion develops a interesting position. He maintains that there's a difference between a present danger
and
a future danger. You walk under the Leaning Tower of Pisa, a Kaisel Ru'uah, the danger's here. It can fall any minute. That you're not allowed to do. That Chazal recognizes the danger. The Yerdei Hayam, you go out on the sea voyage. When you leave, the sea is tranquil. There's no storm. Who knows what can happen in a trip that lasts weeks and maybe even months. That's a future danger. And then he proceeds to add one other qualification. He thinks that these future dangers can be accepted as part of Shem Ripsoim Hashem, because you don't think about what's going to happen in the future, presumably, provided that in the majority of cases there will be no danger. And he bases that upon the Mishnah, the Gemara in Brachos. It says there's a nochosh that's around your calf. You're not allowed to be mafsik, but an akrov, a scorpion, the Gemara says you have to. You can be paisik, you interrupt the middle of Shemin Esrei. What's the difference? He quotes the Rambam, the Pirush Mishnayos, who in turn is quoted by the Bar Tanura. Says a nochosh usually doesn't do anything. A akrov is different. In both cases, right now they're not biting. And there's a chance that the nochosh is going to bite, but it's in the future. The akrov, more than 50% of the time, he's going to bite. Therefore, it's osur. Now, if you take the Binyan Tzion, the issue is really a very simple one. Shem Ripsoim Hashem is A, when people don't perceive it as being a danger, if they really consider it as being a danger, and there's nothing in life which isn't dangerous, I assure you. You get up every morning and you make a life and death decision, and there's a danger in whichever way you decide. If you decide not to get out of bed, there is a statistical danger that you'll throw an embolism, and cholila, that's not very good for you. You get a stroke as a result. You can die as a result. If you do get out of bed, forget about everything that happens in the course of daily activity, you can bang your head against the bedpost, and you'll get a hematoma, and you can die as a result of that. One of the Rosh Yeshiva, and Yeshivas Rabbein Yisrael Rahonon, decades ago, who went to Eretz Yisrael, precisely that happened to him. He banged his head against the bed, and unfortunately, he was nifter. So that, but those decisions are in the category of Shem Ripsoim. So first, if we did wake up every morning and weigh and balance the dangers of staying in bed and dangers of getting up, we would certainly become neurotics, and that's not very good for your health either. So you have a right and even an obligation to rely on the Rebbeinu Shleilim and say Shem Ripsoyim. The Binyan Siyan plugs in when there is a danger that people actually consider. And it's in those cases that the Binyan Siyan says the Gevor invokes the principle of Shem Ripsoyim Hashem, because Doshi Berabim, people do these things without thinking too much about it. They even know that there's a danger, but they ignore it. And he adds the caveat, it's only for something in the future, and it's not a roif, not a majority of cases, that is going to lead to an unfortunate result.
But so Rabbi Blatt, let me just sum up. You believe that a parent does have an obligation to inoculate their child, and certainly the latest medical studies would they've come out even more with new studies that autism, et cetera, have been debunked. Mm-hmm. And additionally, you say that on as far as a school accepting a child, it's a tension between the parents should be doing the right thing, but on the other hand, you recognize the concept of individuality, and it would have to be judged on a case-by-case basis.
No, that's not quite what I said. Although I said that, but I think I said more than that. What I have said is that I think that a parent has an obligation to inoculate the child. I don't think that's a matter of Shem Ripsoyim, and you could say I don't want to rely on Shem Ripsoyim. I think the danger is virtually non-existent. It doesn't even rise to the danger of Shem Ripsoyim. I also think that it depends. I began much earlier by saying that there's some circumstances in which there's no danger that I have to inoculate against. If we were living someplace in which every child in the school, except one, is inoculated, I don't really think that anybody would be in a position to say that we insist that this 100th child be inoculated. Now, of course, I don't think that you can live in a society in which you can hide the fact that the child hasn't been inoculated, and you have to contend with the possibility that if one child opts out, then other children are going to opt out, and you can no longer piggyback on the herd effect. Where there is a valid herd effect, nobody needs an inoculation, as long as you keep it a secret from everybody else.
I understand. Can I somewhat take the topic a little bit to this, make a little bit of a leap? And if you feel that you don't want to answer the question, I would respect that.
Yeah.
but also in the same concept, the prophylactic medicine. Very recently, much has been said about the BRCA1 and 2 gene.
Yes.
Right? So let me ask the following question. A woman, Rahman al-Atzvan, has cancer. She has the BRCA gene. Would her siblings, who have a high likelihood of having the gene too, have an obligation to be tested? Because given that the BRCA gene, between ovarian cancer and breast cancer, the risk of dying of cancer is in the mid-70%. So would you say that there would be an obligation?
Contracting, not dying necessarily.
Of attracting cancer.
World of difference.
Agreed. Would the siblings have an obligation to be tested? A similar concept, prophylactically.
Look. There are several factors that have to go into an answer. Number one, it's not a new question. There is a very brief tshuva in Igros Moshe in which he was talking about genetic testing for Tay-Sachs, and he makes the very obvious comment that now that there is a test for the carrier state, one can no longer rely on Shem Ripsoyim Hashem. And he uses what I consider to be even strong language. The terminology he uses seems to establish an obligation to determine whether or not you're a carrier. Now,
but
I'm not going
I
to...
I understand, but there's a substantial difference between that, where it just don't date somebody else, and here, where the person doesn't really have an option.
Well, I understand. You spoke about doing this prophylactically. Determining that you have a that you are a carrier state for BRCA 1 or 2 doesn't help you. I shouldn't say that. It's not a cure. The fact that you've determined that you may be a carrier doesn't mean that now that you know this, that the knowledge is going to ward off the disease. The question is, why are you trying to find out? You're trying to find out, I hope, because if you are aware that you're a carrier, there are things that can be done to detect it earlier than otherwise, and I'm firmly convinced that it does make a difference, and that you can't just tell every woman, act as if you're a carrier, even if you're not a carrier. And if you can tell that to a woman, you can't tell it to every doctor, because there's a different kind of attention, zehirus, when you know that there's a real danger than when you're doing these things just pro forma. And I'm not even talking now about medicines and other procedures that could or might be done prophylactically. That's a medical decision to be made. But you can't make a decision unless you're in command of the facts. I think it's a very, very good idea for any woman who thinks she might be a carrier to be tested to find out whether she is a carrier. The differences in her treatment are going to be very practical at the very outset. She will have regular mammograms at an earlier age than otherwise. And when a medical practitioner does the breast examination, it's going to be a more careful scrutiny than it would be otherwise. And those are simple things, innocuous. Nobody died of the breast examination and the mammograms we believe to be relatively innocuous. Other things carry with them other types of danger, and we don't even have to talk about them.
So would you believe that it's a chiyuv similar to prophylactically inoculation to say, if you, in your family you have a history of this gene, you have a halachic chiyuv, also shmartem esnaf sheisechem, or et cetera, drabanan, deraisa, to go and be tested?
You're making a very strong statement. You're saying that it's an absolute chiyuv to be tested.
No, I'm asking a question.
Yeah, I understand. Okay. Whether it rises to the level of an absolute chiyuv, I'm not certain. I do think that if you know that there is, you know, the fact that there has been cancer in the family doesn't necessarily mean that it came because the person who had the cancer had BRCA1 or BRCA2. Remember that if you're going to apply the Binyan Siyan and say, can I or can I not rely on Shem Soyim Hashem, you're going to have to determine whether the majority of cancers came as a result of the gene or whether they come from other causes. That's a complicated medical question. So, you know, talking about Chiyuvim is talking in rather strong terms. However, and again, the difference between avoiding danger and proactively doing things to avert danger. This isn't a kir notui, it's not a kesarua. You're now looking for ways that may ward off the danger. And I think it is a very, very good idea for these women to be tested. Whether it rises to an absolute chiyuv in terms of halacha, it's hard to say that it rises to an absolute chiyuv in this case for another reason as well, which I just hinted at before, and that is I'm convinced that the doctor will be much more careful in his examination if he knows he's dealing with a carrier, but it doesn't mean that you can't have a Yerusha mind of a practitioner out there who says that he treats all his patients that way and he doesn't have to waste the time and the money on the genetic test. He treats them all as if they were carriers. I hope there's such malachim around. For those malachim, the patients don't necessarily have to have the BRCA, particularly if the doctor has told them that the more dangerous interventions he won't recommend anyway. So you're left only with these things that are more or less routine, and the question is, how careful are you with these routine examinations? So using language of chiyuv is rather strong. But
you would strongly advise,
and you can even convince me in some circumstances.
So I would like to thank very much Rav HaGaon, Rabbi Yehuda David Bleich, perhaps the preeminent medical ethicist and halacha in America, for his opinion both on vaccinations and schools' acceptance of non-acceptance of non-vaccinated children, and his discussion about the BRCA gene. Thank you very much for the covet of appearing on our show, Rabbi Bleich.
Thank you. Kol tov.
Next guest will be Rabbi Peretz Scheinemann, the dean of the New England Academy of Torah and an expert in chinuch. And we will be speaking about raising children in today's very open society and very consumer-driven society. Welcome, Rabbi Scheinemann.
Thank you.
So, Rabbi Scheinemann, would you think it's fair to say that parents today, in many ways, are more challenged bringing up healthy, you know, morally healthy children than in any generation in history?
100%. I think the challenges of the street, the challenges of modern society, so much being out there, so much accessibility, make it much more challenging in terms of parenting and the skills that we need to have to raise children in the manner that you describe.
So as an expert mechanech, educator, give us a few pointers. What would you tell parents?
So the first is, it's an interesting concept, is that I found that many of the things that are applicable for teachers are equally applicable for parents. And I once did a survey, and I have since repeated it numerous times with different age groups. It was a survey to ask students about what they felt in terms of having been in school for so many years, and which teacher would they say was their best teacher, and to jot that down on a sheet of paper, and then to give me the reason why. And ultimately, what came out was that 9 out of 10 of the answers really had absolutely nothing to do with education, the curriculum, and the classes, but it was much more about the personality. Ultimately, it was about the person that really cared the most, the teacher that cared the most, the principal that cared the most. And it was based on that that I kind of coined a phrase that I share with parents and with students all the time, which is that people don't care how much you know till they know how much you care. And obviously, the more care we're able to show to our children, the more understanding that we're able to show to our children, the more of a chance that we have to be successful. And often people misinterpret the words that we hear. We hear unconditional love, which is kind of the buzz phrase that we've been hearing for a number of years, that, you know, kids are in a difficult place and they need unconditional love. And I think we'll talk a little bit about that tonight, because it really needs to be unconditional love, but there also needs to be boundaries as well. Again, every case is different, and certainly with certain children, they need much more love. They probably need nine doses of love out of 10. But you know, for the average child, for most children, love together with boundaries is a healthy relationship.
Now, how would you, Rabbi Scheinman, how would you advise parents to deal with their children and the internet?
Okay, so again, I think that ultimately the internet is really a difficult challenge, simply in terms of the fact that it very much depends on where the family is coming from, and I think everyone has their own red lines in the sand. So I think that from the perspective of chinuch, obviously, you know, to some degree, it's wise for us to always follow the advice of our rabbis and to understand that as an educator, I can share with you that the internet can be quite dangerous and quite insidious in terms of children and their access to the internet.
As well as adults.
On the other hand, that's correct, as well as adults. However, at the same time, there is the concept that if a child wants to get internet, they're able to, meaning you can walk up and down the street and pick up a hotspot. A child can babysit for a couple of hours and go to Walmart and pick themselves up a cell phone with data. So I think, you know, certainly any family that's going to allow internet into their home needs to do so with, number one, very careful filtering, needs to do so with being able to make sure that the computer should be in a public place where a child does not have that ability, to access the computer in a private place. There are also many programs there that parents can use to track. But I think also it's important for every parent to understand their given child. And if the child shows, the kind of maturity that they need, and even then it's, questionable, But if they're able to show that kind of maturity, so then, you know, perhaps there's, you know, some room for relationships of trust. And again, to use very, very strong gedarim in terms of your own house and in terms of how that works, to make sure that you can try and keep it safe. I've certainly run into many cases where, unfortunately, that safety fails. So for the families that are able to employ higher strategies, such as perhaps not even having it in their home, or having, you know, higher level, processes within their own home, they should certainly be blessed, and certainly they're, I think, to some degree, doing their children a great service. It's a difficult topic. The internet's a difficult topic because kids can, if not, just take it underground. And I think parents underestimate what their children are able to access if they really want to. So I think that would be probably my key.
So how would you say, given today's challenges, and given that you are a quote-unquote modern mechanech, and the respect is that you're in tune with the challenges, what would you say to parents, what do they have to do differently today than it would have been 100 years ago in the shtetl or in Warsaw or in Krakow?
So I think, again, it extends to many, many different levels of parenting. I think the first is to be able to establish enough of a relationship that if a child were to run into crisis somewhere in their life, they would actually turn to their parents. I know that Rabbi Yanky Horowitz did a survey in the mountains one summer, asked about 100 teenagers, and inevitably the answer was the same. Their parents would actually be the last person they would turn to. So, you know, being able to teach parents, teach children to have that kind of a relationship with their parents where they would come to them is something that's certainly useful and crucial. I think the other thing is that many kids today suffer from lack of self-esteem. It's a trying society. So the ability to offer them lots of security, to be able to validate them, but also to be able to teach them that they are empowered to make the right decisions in their life and that we can't really force them one way or the other. I know of a parent that basically moved into an out-of-town setting, and their personal policy was that they would not necessarily watch TV or allow their children to watch anything. But they told their child, look, you know, you're living, it's a small town, and at some level we can't watch you 24 hours a day. You know where we stand on these things and how we feel about them, and you need to be able to make good choices. And I think empowering kids to make choices is useful. The end of that particular story was that the child was invited to a birthday party. The parent came to pick up their child, and when they arrived at the birthday party, the son wasn't there. They said, where is he? He said, oh, well, we started showing this movie, and he asked if we had a bicycle that he could ride, and he went off and rode his bicycle. So rather than, it's not a question of everything just being a no, you can't do it, but being able to explain things, first of all, and being able to empower them to make good decisions is something that's useful. I often teach children, parents, and educators what I call my 10 two-letter magic words, which is, if it is to be, it is up to me. Meaning that I can't force a student, a child, to do necessarily you know, what I want them to do. It's very much up to them. Kids can take it underground. If they want to violate what we believe in and what we're sharing with them is our belief system, they could do so. But empowering them to believe that they can actually have an effect on their own life is something that I believe is crucial.
We're speaking to Rabbi Peretz Scheinemann, the Dean of the New England Torah Academy and an expert mechanech. So you're saying that empowering and trusting your child and telling them that you trust them is critical.
Correct. Obviously, to some degree, they need to earn that trust. You know, and I think also is to understand that, you know, a lot of this is about responsibility. Often we'll ask a child may get into trouble and you ask them what happened, then inevitably they say, it's not my fault. And what I try to teach, again, parents and children, is that our home or our school is a fault-free zone. You can say it's not my responsibility. You can't say that it's not my fault. And I've actually often heard, you know, children later on in life complaining that they actually feel cheated because their parents let them do whatever they want. We used to have a principal, she used to say, the inmates don't run the asylum. And I think at some level today, we're often running with parents that are almost scared of their children, afraid that their children are, going to go off to derech or something bad is going to happen if they offer them any kind of real structure.
Why, Rabbi Shineman, do you feel that children today have image and self-conscious and low esteem issues more than prior generations?
I think a lot of that is the fact that, you know, information today is accessible very, very quickly. Something happens, whether it's in Israel or whether it's in Argentina or any place else, and within 5 minutes it's public information. So children that do have access, and even if they don't have access, they have friends that have access, are exposed to many things that, we as children, when we grew up, simply, you know, it took months to hear about them. You know, you didn't hear about them. They weren't out there. And today, information is rapid fire. And the kinds of things that kids are seeing today often are scary. So to some degree, I think kids are always feeling a bit insecure.
Now, what do you feel?
Also,
I'm sorry, continue.
There were years as well, you know, with the economical downturn, et cetera. So financially, there were families that were struggling, kids that were struggling, and not feeling that they had that sense of security. So the ability to feel validated is able to change that.
Now, what is your feeling about quality time with parents as opposed to quantity time with parents, and especially with parents who may both be working, or you can have a father in kollel and the mother supporting the family? What would you advise parents as far as the amount of time to spend with a child?
So again, I think the key is, as you described, quality time is to some degree much more important than the quantity of time, because if a father is in the room, as I would advise parents, to the degree that it's possible, if there is a central time when families can eat together, obviously it doesn't always work. But if we're able to do that, that's certainly something that's useful. But again, it's only useful if it's really quality time. If the father is taking phone calls or the mother is taking phone calls throughout, then essentially the quality is really not there, because the child eventually feels like, my father's really not interested. You know, he's busy doing his thing. I think, you know, the quality of time, you know, I think if a child feels that their parent really cares and that their parent is there for them, that's important. I think it's important to validate kids. So if a child comes through and has some difficulty that's happening at school, while we can hear them and we can validate them, the last thing that we want to do is to put down or to downplay the Rebbe, the Mechanech, the Menahel, the teacher, whoever it might be, that's working day by day in the classroom, because ultimately that child will never be able to learn from that principal or teacher again, because their parents have basically destroyed their ability to do that. So again, I think quality time is more important than quantity, and at times as well, making a specific child feel special. In other words, if you do it on a rotation, and rather than taking the entire family out for pizza, it might be on a rotation that on Sunday mornings I take out Chaim this week and I take out Sarah the next week, and it's one by one, and the child, that as long as it's done in a fair and equitable way, it works quite well.
So, Rabbi Shineman, if you had to give our listeners three cardinal rules and say, because it's usually, you know, it's hard to remember a dozen, say, from my years of experience of thousands of children I've seen through schools, here are three things as parents you should do, what would they be?
I think number one is that we have to be good role models for our children. Children are quite smart, and children see through things. Dr. Jerry Loeb recently said at a national convention that I attended, he said, we don't have children at risk. We often have adults that are at risk. In other words, many people that may attend Shacharis, Mincha, and Ma'ariv may attend their shiurim or their tafyomi in the evening, but they're really not with the program. In other words, they're kind of, as we would put it, doing Judaism. And kids are quite smart. In other words, if a child has a father who's telling him, you need a shtag, you need to learn more, but the father's not learning much, so obviously the child eventually gets the picture. It's important for me, but it's not important for him. So how important is it really? So I think, you know, being able to be real about we say about what we say is something that's crucial. I think the concept, obviously, and I think it goes without saying, is the caring phenomena. And if a child is struggling, rather than the anger associated with you did this and this and I'm so angry and you let down the family and it's going to look terrible for us, etc., or whatever other reasons that the child might say, it's more important to try and get into the symptom of the reason why the child's feeling that way, and basically through a caring relationship, hopefully we're able to resolve some of those types of problems. And the last one that I would say is, I think, is a tricky one, is that we live in a very difficult society, which is, you know, basically what we call a society of selfies. If we look at it, selfie became the word of the year a year ago, and 93% of teenagers take pride in regularly using and taking selfies. There was a 17,000% increase in the use. And the message of the selfies is always the same, which is me, me, and me. Having children involved in chesed to the extent possible is something that actually, it's probably one of the most important things in developing healthy children that will be able to grow into caring adults. And I think it's crucial because ultimately what it does is it takes people that can tend to be, that tend to have grown up in a society of takers, and it actually changes them into givers. So, well, I think that's something that's crucial.
So thank you very much. That was Rabbi Peretz Scheinemann, the Dean of the New England Torah Academy and an expert in chinuch, his three rules for bringing up healthy children. Thank you very much, Rabbi Scheinemann. Next week we will have the Rosh Yeshiva of Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan. Rabbi Herschel Schechter will be speaking about bankruptcy in halacha. And following that, Dr. Pelkowitz will be speaking about the internet and your family. To speak to you next week, thank you so much. This is David Lichtenstein.